All of this, I should back up, a lot of what we know about the princes and the dismantling of a lot of myths is from Gretchen Gerzina's book, Mr. and Mrs. Prince, how an extraordinary 18th century family moved out of slavery and into legend. I'm drawn to the things we cannot see. I am drawn to the spooky element of things.
Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm Bianca Stone.
And I'm Ben Pease.
And today we're talking with the writer and artist Chantalie Gander. Chantalie Gander is an incredible artist and writer. She's the author of the poetry collection Ghetto Claustrophobia. She's a reporter at VPR. Her incredible project, Dark Goddess, an exploration of the sacred feminine, an exhibition of her photo series of the same name, 6 years in the making, is currently on display at the Fleming Museum of Art. She gives lectures on the life of Lucy Terry Prince as a member of the Vermont Humanities Council Speakers Bureau, which is one of the reasons why we're talking with her today in honor of Black History Month. Mm-hmm. So Shanta, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Bianca and Ben, for having me.
Can I ask a new question? Before we get into Lucy Terry Prince, the number of projects that you do are all varied. What inspires you to move from one to the other?
Oh, that is a really good question. I've never given birth to children, but I know about the letdown that happens in breast milk and that process. And I know that with projects, especially some that are long-term, there's that post-project depression. I guess for me, I never have to have post-project depression. I never have to have letdown happen. And I'm drawn. I'm continually the string between all of it. I mean, all of it, whether you're talking about photography, writing, journalism, belly dance, whenever I, re-engage with that. It's going beneath the surface of whatever, like the story, but also the inquiry, and maybe inspiring others to ask questions of themselves that they might not be invited to ask. Also pleasure. Mm. I want to give people pleasure, even if that pleasure has a bittersweet, hurt so good feeling, because my work is not necessarily all about roses are red, violets are blue, mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
And so you make sure your timelines that there's always something else going when the first thing has stopped, right?
That's kind of... they almost like stagger. They mm-hmm. almost like some of there are a couple of projects right now I'm involved with that are long term. I'm like in a committed relationship with all these projects and collaborators, mm-hmm. and they stagger.
Well, I was gonna say that the Dark Goddess project, it really seems to have taken on a life of its own, and I just love how every time I see it come up in the news, it's always got some new element to it, and it's really evolving and moving, and has many people involved and. In institutions as well. And that's really some of my favorite artists like you are totally like that. It's just things happen around you and people get involved and conversations get made and like other people are making art, not just you. And the conversations happening between people and also between the art and the community that's looking at the art. So it's just so wonderful. And what I love about the Lucy Terry Prince project, I mean, I kind of call it a project because just everything I've read about it is just there's so much that's happening from the inquiry into her life, mm-hmm. giving, and that there's so much activity around finding out more about her and her world that she built around her family and her endeavors. So tell us, let's just start from the top. Who is Lucy Terry Prince?
So she is, she's an orator, she's a poet, storyteller, mother, landowner, her and her husband, her and her husband, Abijah Prince. Yes, and they had six children together. Between, we think somewhere between 1728 and 1730, she's kidnapped from Africa, is enslaved. Want to make a note that I will be using language like enslavers and enslaved because of the power dynamic that it has, and also as not to see the enslaved as objects, even though that's a complicated conversation about objects given my museum work. But so Lucy Terry Prince eventually is sold to a reverend and his wife in Deerfield, Mass. And so she, you know, part of her task, she works in the tavern. She meets Abijah Prince somewhere, we want to say 1747, 1749. During this time when they meet and then eventually marry, they are building their life. You know, Abijah is getting, securing land in Guilford.
Because he's now a free man.
Yeah, free man.
You probably also have to be a free man to buy land.
Well, allies too. There were some allies who'd put his name on a list, on a roster for land. So lots of land. Yeah, some white allies also. Who? Yeah, so it's a very interesting, it was complicated too because a little bit later, something crops up where they lose their Sunderland land because it was very easy to, you know, sell land, give it away to a couple, or if there was a notice for taxes and someone didn't see it, then you lose your land. Wow. But that's like further down. They eventually, so Abijah negotiates his freedom. Lucy Terry Prince is not named in the will of the Wellses. And so therefore free.
I see. She wasn't named as property.
Nope. And so all of this, I should back up. A lot of what we know about the princes and the dismantling of a lot of myths is from Gretchen Gerzina's book, Mr. and Mrs. Prince, how an extraordinary 18th century family moved out of slavery and into legend. Because there's still a lot of myths. People will Google, people have done ridiculous things, like argue with Gretchen about her research, right? And it's a lot of debunking, but what we know is she argued twice for her rights not to be harassed, because as soon as they get into Guilford, they're harassed.
By their neighbors. They're racist neighbors who don't want black people living next door.
They wanted their land too. They wanted their land.
They wanted their land, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we also learn from their life, like there are a couple of things we learn from the princes. We learn about, you know, contributions to early America, like what that really looked like in real life. We learn that enslavement in the North, for example, enslaved people, you know, they could be bid out by their enslavers as long as like the profits were coming back to enslavers. They could travel state lines in a way. We tend to overly focus on the South. We forget to see like what was enslavement in the West or
right. And I think for someone who grew up in the Northeast, when they're learning about slavery in school and all you're learning about is like the cotton plantations, it just doesn't seem real, you know. Like I think like learning about how all the intricacies of all of America and how it was all functioning is, I mean, that's very new for most people. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially like something as immediate for a Vermonter as like how slavery was working, like in mm-hmm. Vermont and Massachusetts.
Or even Connecticut. Because you know, one of the neighbors harassing the princes, they believe he's from a part of Connecticut that had plantations. And we have to remember, it's something I'd studied a bit in undergrad. We have to remember that plantations were not all these big sprawling ones. Some of them were as simple as a simple home that had maybe a few enslaved people, not a sprawling industry.
Again, we just only see this one picture of what
like at the tenement museum, a sweatshop could be an apartment that had 12 people working in it, you know, nonstop. So, Shanti, I was wondering, in I think your article in the Brattleboro paper, it was just kind of a almost like an aside about how the amount of kind of acreage of land owned by African Americans and how it kind of went down over time. I'm wondering if the Lucy Terry Prince story in some ways is almost like a case study in that, and how they would land would be acquired, but how many forces would be set against them to take it away.
That was so heartbreaking about the story. I mean, that they worked so hard to acquire this land, but then it was like this just constant onslaught of it being taken, threat of being taken away.
Yeah, it's an American story, like in a way, because like right now, for example, the Gullah lands is like in the South under attack. People trying to hold on to that ancestral land. There's also the stats. So long after Lucy and Abijah pass, they're within a constellation. So 1965, 1910, you have 15 million acres owned by Black Americans and their descendants. By 1920, 14% of all farms owned, or like what, close to 950,000 Black farmers. Now, about less than 1% of Black Americans owned rural land. And then if you were to look at stats for home ownership, which I don't have at the top of my head, but like just looking at home ownership, it's more common that you would have. No, so even take myself. I have a couple of advanced degrees. I've never owned a home. But I know people who didn't graduate high school are white. Yeah. They are homeowners. So we're thinking about distribution of resources, what happened towards the end of Lucy's life. Her sons actually brought a case to the highest court at the time in Vermont, you know, the governors and council, about their Sunderland land. And, you know, Lucy argued an appeal and they didn't get their land back, but they owed her a place. She's like, I am owed a place. You know, to
who took her land?
So what happened, there was a lot of wheeling and dealing back in the day around land. It was very sloppy. It's not like it is now where you have a deed. It's very legal. It is very yours. What could happen is someone could resell or give, you know, to several people. They all have a claim. They may not know it. What Gretchen believes happened, what she talks about in the book, is that there may have been some announcement of collection of taxes up in that area that Abijah didn't see. And therefore, totally fucked up.
Yeah.
And so therefore, there they are in court in what, like 1803. And so therefore, arguing over like towards the end of her life, because she goes and lives closer to her sons in Sunderland towards the end of her life after her husband passes. But you're right in picking up that the turmoil and the grief, like soon as they get into Guilford, they're being harassed in so many different ways. Destruction of crops, property, and they fight back.
Did I read that their well was poisoned? And
oh, that's interesting. I would have to look that. It was more like Stanton and Noyes did things like, you know, let the animals out, or go, you know, knock down things. When she wins her case for protection, literally a few months later, he gets a band of people together to go like do more destruction to their land.
So she was constantly going into the court and arguing against, you know, being harassed, simply.
She did it twice. Yeah, she did it twice. Once for the harassment, the second time for the access to the Sunderland land. Abijah, is key because he teaches his whole family and show, like, including his wife, leveraging the law. So, for example, someone had owed wages to his son, you know, right. and he had his records. Someone owed him money because he would go back and forth and buy goods for people. And he took them to court. So he was, they reverse on saying, yeah. okay, well, this is owed. Here are our records.
And she was raised by a minister. So she probably had a lot of practice with the oratory arts. Mm. And it probably helped her.
That's a very good point.
Do we know much about her life as a poet? Was that something that she, that she was passionate about, or was it sort of a one-time thing? Her famous poem Bar Fights is the only surviving poem of hers. Am I right?
That's it. Yeah, you are right. And it's a very good question. And that's the only one we know of, which also, so as I say, penned very loosely in 1746. It survives an oral tradition until it appears in print for the first time in 1854. And so it's all oral for like about 100 years or so.
So 100 years, this ballad written by a Black woman in Guilford, mm-hmm. Vermont, is passed down. And it's a poem that's about
a raid.
A raid.
Yep, on Deerfield. And she's enslaved at the time. And in Deerfield at the time.
Oh, in Deerfield at the time.
She creates,
okay.
Yep, she creates the poem. And so, I mean, it makes her also the first known African-American poet mm-hmm. in the U.S. So it's a very interesting poem, you know, in terms of tone. I can read it if you want.
Yeah, I think we should read it. It's just to pause for a moment over this idea mm-hmm. of the first African-American woman poet, which, of course, is probably not true at all. It's just the first one published.
Right, it survived into the record, right? If it was all oral tradition, then others are, you know, were there.
It's amazing how... I don't even know how to think of the oral tradition of poetry nowadays, because we are so... locked into the written page and the publication. And this, her poem, like you said, 100 years or so after its creation, is published on the in the paper. And that's,
I like what you said that about, like, written, though, because I've been thinking a lot about orality. And so, for example, Black tradition, right?
Yeah.
There was something called filled challah work songs. And so there's that, and some of where those songs come from, we may not know the originators of those songs. And you back further, the griot, who basically, they were genealogists, they were historians. It was oral, straight up oral, passed down to a point where, so when we think about text, I wonder if text is a very specific, I don't want to say imperialistic or colonial, because I'm still trying to wrap my head around what those words even mean.
Right.
But I think it's a very English thing. I think it's a very specific thing.
Yeah.
But then I shouldn't even say English either, because all sorts of old cultures, you know, even what, like Irish, Celtic, like when you get to all these things, I think there's a way that there is a lot of oral, and but then when something is committed to text, like I just learned that Beowulf, because it was a Christian monk who penned it, they kind of painted the Vikings in a certain way.
Of and course, like, yeah.
Christian messages in there, but they had the power of the pen. So there's a way that I've been thinking very differently about, we question intelligence because it's like text versus.
Yeah, can you read or not?
Work. Yeah.
And it's funny to think about those old texts too, because I think the Druids or something, like writing things down was like only for the, like people who spoke to the gods or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, something like that. And then it was the Christians, and maybe the Romans too, that brought in the, you know, written text and keeping records and like keeping records of land, of course, and things like that. It became more about, and then there was so much beauty, you know, like, of course, you and I, we love written to text too. You know, we love, you know, there's so much beauty in that. I love that there isn't, it isn't one or the other, of course, that, like both have.
But there's a book, I mean, I was just thinking about modern day, right? Which books of poetry get published? Is there selected? They win a contest, you know, they're given to an agent, they're, you know, there's a merit to them, you know. I mean, of course, you can go on Amazon CreateSpace and just print your book up. You know, there's other way you can just make your own, but there's the ones that get out there.
Just, what if you're just oral? What if you're just spoken word? What if you just slam? And I'm not a slammer. I've been writing poetry all my life, but there was a like long time when I was younger. I never read it out loud because I didn't sound like, you know, Russell Simmons' Def Jam poetry, because I didn't sound like that. So and I thought it was so awesome. I was just like, oh, I guess this is just little me in my corner. Just
right.
Like, so it took a long time for me to be today years old and be like, oh, I can publish this.
Right. Well, it's, you know, but in thinking back to the context we're talking about with Lucy Terry Prince's stuff and her being seen, you know, there's something sort of.
I wonder her being in a tavern too, you know, like that was a good place to like disseminate it.
Well,
you know, she could recite it there and all these people from all over would hear it and say,
right,
oh,
she
man,
was at the tavern. She was probably, yeah. You know.
Well, and she recited the Bible. Like she knew the Bible, allegedly, like knew it well. Committed to memory. She was a storyteller. So there's a lot of dimension to Lucy. So much.
She must have been such a strong and interesting and dynamic person. Just the little that I've seen. It's just so incredible. I feel so... You know, the sad thing about not having things written down or, you know, if people don't pass it down is that they when they you know all the people will never know that they have beautiful poems and beautiful things and will you read us the infamous Bar Fights poem by Lucy Terry Prince? And you said before that, did you say that the word bars is actually for an old word for fields, and this is meadow, not meadow?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like not like what we
it
would
seems
think.
Seems like a bar brawl.
Bars, bar brawl. No, and I always make that joke, not a bar brawl, but as in a colonial term for meadow. And to lay a little bit of context, so this is. Second raid in 4 decades on Deerfield, Mass. The raid included 60 Abenaki men under a French commander. And forgive me, everybody, for messing the name up because I don't speak fluent French. Vaudreuil. So, you know, it's a very historical document of this raid. So, here is the only surviving poem that we know of by Lucy Terry Prince called Bars Fight. August 'twas 25th, 1746. The Indians did an ambush lay some very valiant men to slay, the names of whom I'll not leave out. Samuel Allen like a hero fought. And though he was so brave and bold, his face no more shall we behold. Elijah Hawks was killed outright before he had a chance to fight, before he did the Indian see, was shot and killed immediately. Oliver Amson, he was slain, which caused his friends much grief and pain. Simeon Amson they found dead, not many rods distant from his head. Adonijah Gilead, we do hear, did lose his life, which was so dear. John Sadler fled across water and thus escaped the dreadful slaughter. Eunice Allen saw the Indians coming and thought she could escape by running. And had not her petticoat stopped her, the awful creatures would not have caught her, nor tomahawked her on the head, leaving her on the ground for dead. And young Samuel Allen Oh, lackaday, he was taken and carried to Canada. Now, again, 1746, she's still enslaved.
Still living with her.
With the Wells, yeah, the Wells. Enslavers, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, there, I mean, some of the, I even wonder some of the rhymes, I feel like, is where you see the most kind of character coming out in some ways. Mm-hmm. Even the, so we're looking at a version, you know, and it was, some of the words were different from your version, which is kind of interesting. But we had, where was it? You know, I'll not leave out a hero, Fout, you know, F-O-U-T. Yes. And part of me is like, you know, is that the kind of line where, like, when you are saying it out loud, you can kind of get a little rise out of people because you're kind of squeezing the rhyme a little bit to make that work, you know? For some reasons, slaughter and water sounds like that. I hear the Boston accent coming out. Wada, slaughter, you know? And obviously the last, you know, the last two lines, lackaday, candidate. And I guess part of me, we all talked about this before, but I saw that there's a sort of, you know, she can't come out and be as critical as she might have wanted to, but you see it kind of rising as close as she can in some ways.
Critical about what?
About the white men, you know, about the those who had enslaved her, you know, that her feeling towards these people is not just sympathy for their.
It's interesting you say that because I had one poet ask me what would this have looked like without white gaze. Like, I'm fascinated. I've been obsessed with gaze and seeing unseen. What's interesting, even with Phyllis Wheatley's poetry, like, what would some of the poetry look like minus white gaze or the gaze of, like, some people have asked questions about a feeling of something derogatory towards Indigenous people in this. And then again, it's thinking about context and place in the moment.
And we also have to remember that poetry at this time was not like poetry now. It was not about your personal feelings. It was
persona, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Persona. Yeah. I mean, I would actually argue still persona to some extent, like persona where you're saying, well, that's the poem speaking, not me necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also the Native Americans are not characterized they're not, the ways they're mentioned in the poem is almost as kind of extras almost, you know, they're, she doesn't turn them into savages or something, the way they're written, you know.
Yeah, it's very factual. It seems more about honoring the names of the people. Like, they're all, like, their full names are in here.
Well, it makes it a record. It makes it, and the way that I have been trying to explore what the history or meaning or even roles of griots are, you know, in African culture, their role, one of many, what's their genie.
Can you tell me about that term, griots?
Sure, yeah. So storytellers, okay. You know, but they're not just storytellers, though. They have a long laundry list of things they do, like genealogists. They are history keepers. There's so many. Also, I do want to add, I'm no expert in this, but one of the things I started exploring is that there's some debate even about the term griot and griot. So I just want to put that out there. But so very much based in orality. Right. And so there's a way in which I'm thinking, even though Lucy was very young when she was kidnapped, she's connected to memory and heritage in a certain way with the fact that she was an orator, with the fact that this has a genealogical feel, a historical record keeping feel of it. There are two, or at least I want to say three survivors based off, and there's been some record that, you know, Eunice Allen survived and recounted this day to a journalist some years later. Samuel Allen, they eventually sent a family member to go fetch him, and he tried to pretend he didn't understand English anymore. Which there are lots of narratives about people wanting to stay in the indigenous communities of which they become a part of somehow.
Do you know if he did end up leaving or did he stay? Or
he did. He did. He got his arm twisted by this family member. It did end up leaving, and then years later looked upon that moment as one of his fondest. Very fascinating.
Yeah, it's probably really messed up mm-hmm. in the end about it all. But who knows? I mean, yeah, it's...
So Griot, they were... I'm sorry, I was just listening for a while, but they were traveling and they were also had a music element. Is this... Am I remembering?
That, I would say that's... that. My understanding is more like troubadours, even though that's like more European.
Right.
Griots, like I said, I'm still learning about mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. I don't think there was always a music element, but that's something I would have to... Like, that's a good question. I'm not really sure about that. Because there's like such a laundry list of what they served as a function in specific society in Africa, which is so fascinating.
I was going to ask, so you've done, you're kind of doing a number of things in terms of her life, Lucy Terry Prince's, right? Could you talk a little bit about some of what you've done?
Yeah, absolutely. So it started off this speakers being on the Speakers Bureau for the Vermont Humanities. I'm also on the Speakers Bureau for the New Hampshire Humanities Council, talking about Lucy Terry Prince and sharing her life and the life of the princes, really. Right now, I'm actually talking to you from Nantucket. I am involved with Jay Craven's film project Lost Nation, which is designed as a co-narrative looking at the different ways of accessing the American dream by looking at Ethan Allen and looking at the life of the princes and specifically like Lucy Terry Prince. And so, yeah, this like woven co-narrative. And so my role has been as advisor. My role is connecting with some of the actors and actresses who will be in the film, but also the other role that I'm playing right now, I'm teaching a workshop to college students from different colleges, different colleges from around anywhere, right, who are working with Jay, which is a part of the model, to learn about filmmaking. And I'm teaching a course in the self and representation in the arts so that, you know, the intertwining of who gets to control image and narrative. I've talked about Henry the 14th. I talked about a madam named Lulu White from New Orleans and like the red light district and her self-making and what it means when you are an artist, whether you're emerging or getting into film or photography or writing, and how the self and others are seen and represented. And so in thinking about Lucy Terry Prince, what is interesting is we don't have much. And of course, what we do have is pretty significant from Gretchen Gerzina's research.
Yeah, she went deep.
She went deep. And, but then if we're looking at the self, let's say, through this poem, for example, it's really fascinating. Or the history or the idea of how the princes are linked to Black land ownership in the United States and the implications of that.
And the implications of that are extreme, and I hope I'm the not pessimist in me hopes that a conversation around it would start changing things, because the numbers that you were telling me earlier about the decline, that there was a rise in African American land ownership and then a sharp decline up until now. So
absolutely. And linked to, you know, here we have from long after Lucy and Abijah have passed, from 1865 to 1910, Black Americans and their descendants owning 15 million acres. You know, by 1920, 14% of all farmers, you know, or farms being Black owned. And then now less than 1% of rural land in Vermont. There was a few years ago, actually, maybe a year and a half ago, land ownership bill that was trying to be introduced and passed to look at access. And so that is something I believe is still being explored. So there's movement all around the country, different entities, whether through legislation, policy, conversations about reparations even, and what the implications of that. And the conversation about reparations is, whether we know it or not, a very old one.
Yeah.
Very old one.
Yeah.
And one with lots of precedent. It's not like it's not happened before in the United mm-hmm. States, you know, just like people don't think.
Yep.
Which, you know, in thinking about place and land, tangible topography, I noticed on your social media that you were meditating much on this idea of place and can a place hurt people? And you made a really beautiful post on your Facebook page today, your Sunday posts. While on the ferry to Nantucket, I think about how place in my life right now has another dimension alongside this question: what space and place is required for one to feel like they can really do the work or feel safe? What does a hostile place feel like versus one that lends permission to the bodies that occupy that space? And I wonder how you could talk to me a bit about just what got you on this line of thought of place and hostility and...
Well, so I should say, I had not mentioned before in our conversations about this, I'm drawn to the things we cannot see. I am drawn to the spooky element of things. I believe what Newton's law, in one of his laws, energy can be neither created nor destroyed. That being said, I always think about what's left over, a residue of life and things of what, as people touch each other's lives and place. So I've never been to Nantucket before a few weeks ago. And I come to Nantucket and it is charmed and gorgeous. And I'm thinking, God, I would love a studio in Nantucket. You know, how fancy, whatever that means. And then thinking, whoa, you know, I was seeing this stark gap of class. Today I talked to a 12th generation Nantucket woman who was telling me about, and she was a cab driver. Crazy story. And so I started thinking about, okay, is it the place hurting someone, and or is it the residue we leave behind? You know, people who, the average house I was told about 3 million in Nantucket. I would have to fact check that, but the gap, I noticed who was going back and forth on the ferry, what they looked like versus the people who actually live here. And so all that said, I was thinking, well, what, and right now I'm living in a place which I'm thankful to be in, but as we had to leave our apartment because it was being renovated. So talking about place, right? Place is being brought up, land grabbing right now.
Yeah, yeah, it's Vermont, pretty yeah. really intense.
Yeah, it's nasty.
Yeah.
And it doesn't belong to me. It's not my family's land. You know, it's my husband's family's land and gorgeous place.
Yeah, I love that.
I think about the complexity of the strong feelings around the place.
The feelings.
Rightfully so. you know, wanting to protect it. And it doesn't belong to me. It's not, I think, well, you know, what would it mean to have had land passed down? You know, as a child who was homeless with right. their family, you know, a room of one's own and even privacy or a place to actually relax and do work had me thinking a lot back to James Baldwin in an interview in the 1960s talking about why he left America and how America was hostile. So, you know, this is like a complicated answer, and it's a mix of, like, you know, thinking about the insurrection and thinking about how I felt immediately I wanted to get the fuck out of America.
Yeah.
Because I want to freely think about myself as an artist. I'm exhausted thinking about myself as a Black anything to yeah. be one, yeah. you know?
It's like you just want to do your art. You don't have to feel like...
Yeah. I don't want it to be like, oh, this is a statement as an extension of X, Y, and Z. Even though yeah. my second book is very much about an interpretation and interrogation of Ovid's Metamorphosis, but I want it to be entered by any body or any set of bodies.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I've been in this exact situation the past 2 weeks with the Roostone mm-hmm. house, because my whole family has so much emotion around that land and that space, and I do too. And that's, you know, the impetus behind our endeavors with this honestly, like, extremely challenging project that most people would say, look, it's just too much work, it's a money suck, it's, you know, but it's the place that we have put so much emphasis mm-hmm. on. And we're like, not only is it a place where a beautiful writer wrote beautiful poems, I don't know if it's because of that. I don't think it is, because people who don't know anything about her still say that the place has a really magical feel to it. And there's a mm-hmm. certain energy to Goshen that feels unique. But at the same time, it also, there's this negative energy and there's this negative force that is part mm-hmm. of my family. But also Ben and I, we lived up there, and there was some nights that it felt quite spooky. But mm-hmm.
I sat there in the house at night and played the scariest song I could on repeat and said, come on.
It does feel like something is about to materialize in front of you. And you're like, and when I felt that, I said, I don't want it. I don't want to see anything. I've changed my mind.
That's about funny, the occult. We're opposites in this way.
I know. You were fucking playing scary music saying, show me. I'm like, don't show me.
I mean, I basically had like, I realized that I'm a little superstitious about having a fire outside in the daytime.
I don't like doing that at all.
And so I did one because we had ripped off a lot of old wood off the house, and I could see the sun and the fire, and I was exhausted physically, right? But I had a prolonged conversation with my dead mother at that fire. And it was...
I remember that experience, you telling me about that. And you wrote a lot of poems at that time about that.
Yeah,
but that's the kind of energy that goes on there. The point I'm getting
at. Well, you don't know what's going to come through. Like, this is the thing that they say about, like, I was trying to speak to my aunt, my great aunt, and my great grandmother one time in my dreams. I was like, I want to see them in my dreams.
Yeah.
And I remember once trying some interesting steps to try to figure it out. I remember waking and choking. Mm. And like, I wrote a poem about it. Like, it, you know, it's like, a couple of times it happened. I said, okay, I will, you know, if you want to come forward and talk to me, that's fine. I'm going to let you be where you are. Just stay over there. No problem. But yet at the same time, I'm obsessed. How do you make a dead tongue talk?
Mm. Well, it's always this, you know, there's the living we have to contend with, and there's the dead we have to contend with, and then there's the places that we all exist in physically right now. And all those things aren't lining up sometimes. And when that conflict starts to happen, it can be extremely uncomfortable. And my impulse last week was to run. And I was having that impulse that you had with insurrection, which is like, I want to get the fuck out of here. And I just can't deal with these people. Like, it's not like no place is worth dealing with these kinds of people. And, you know, thinking of Lucy Terry Prince and having to deal with her neighbors who are constantly harassing her, like a lot of people in those situations are like, I can't deal with this anymore. Like, I'm just going to pack up and leave. I've heard many stories in Vermont. There was a story right here in Brandon, Vermont, where the neighbors were, you know, shooting their guns in the air all day long and like screaming things.
Well, the guy asked them to stop and they just doubled down on it.
Yeah, they, you know, they were like, you liberal fuckers, you know, we're going to scare them out of town. You know, like, it's our gun right or whatever. And it just got escalated till the people just left town. And it was like, it's always sad when that happens because you're like, oh, the assholes won or something. But you know, and I felt that way about the Rue Stone House, where I was like, I don't, you know, I, you know, what's, it's more, you know, I when you want to run from conflict and rather than just sort of like fight, you don't know if you're giving up or if it's, you know, it's really, I think, more about like, you make your spaces, you know, the spaces don't make you. And it's like, wherever I go, I'm going to be creating poetry with the people I love and making conversations and making things happen. And we don't, you know, bickering over one space. Like, to me, it's, it's, that becomes where it's not actually about the space. It's about some sort of projection of emotion from, that's about past relationships that were never resolved. And it's not about space at all. And to me,
we project onto the space, right? Yeah. Like we, even though it's interesting because there are there's a suicide forest in Japan.
What is that?
It's a forest where they say that when people enter, it is legendary for people to have
killed themselves,
taken their lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but there are places around the world like that have, so for example, in the United States alone, there are several houses like that that are where literally, I forget, where is this house? I wonder if it was in Illinois. There's one house in particular that from an aerial shot, it looks like an upside down cross. It's very interesting, very unassuming. People have talked about entering it and it literally just doing something to you. Now, personally, I can't speak to that, but it's interesting because speaking of, is it people and or is it place? And, you know, and it's just like, well, people hurt people on land or in place, and maybe places do become sentient.
Right.
And they carry that.
I mean, it's like you were saying about the energy not disappearing. I mean, there's no doubt that, I don't know. I just, we don't know. Well, we know that either way we're affected by place. And
this, well, like Vermont, right? Yeah. Like Vermont and Vermont's history, where, so take with the princes. It's very interesting because I do say that landscape, how like its history can inform the forward in a certain way. Right. So Vermont likes to often praise itself for, you know, being the first to say, okay, we took enslavement out of the Constitution. However, there were some, it took years, you know, for example, when adult enslavement was taken out of the Constitution, there was nothing mentioned about children.
What?
And what could happen to them. You had enslavers who were able to take respite. In Vermont, you had, there was, and this is all documented. So Dr. Harvey Imani Whitfield, he's a professor at UVM. There's a book he has, The Problem of Slavery in Early Vermont, 1777 to 1810. And it's an essay. And he, you know, he has primary resources. It's, there was an ad for an individual who'd sought their freedom that was placed in Vermont an ad looking for an individual. There was a debate in Bennington about whether or not to help individuals who were fleeing.
Because people would come to Vermont. Yeah.
It's complicated.
I mean, it's like Vermont can say that all it wants. It doesn't mean it wasn't full of racist people. Still is. And, you know,
Absolutely.
Well, right. And that one, you know, tidy fact can sweep a lot of unsavory things under the rug with that. It seems like, we were ahead of the curve, you know, but actually that was just one thing. And it actually allowed other terrible things to continue because of that kind of.
Well, this has been really amazing, Shanta, and I think I'm just so grateful for all the work that's been done on covering real facts about Lucy Terry Prince, debunking, you know, the mythologies that are incorrect, and that it opens up so many doors and so many other questions and so many other investigations. And it's really showing me that, you know, examining Black history is really dependent upon smaller communities and like really investigating what happens in them. And I think we can find out so much more, like looking in the like old local papers from Brattleboro and stuff like that. Like there's so much nuance to our history that really can tell us so much.
I agree. And I would just say that, no, for me, the new turn has been thinking about, as I think about revising or updating my presentation that I've been giving in my lecture, thinking about how did we get from Lucy Terry Prince to spoken word? What might a trajectory look like? And for me, I don't know, I shun Black History Month in a way because it's like, well, history or any history is like every day for me, right? And like the discovery of, right? But it is true that this moment, it's a reminder. I think if nothing else, I won't be the salty, bitter auntie in the corner. I'll say that holidays are good reminders to press pause and like really bring something to the forefront. But remember, how can we remember to make it just a part of how we live?
Every day.
To explore our communities, our histories, literary history, like the key part, deep, rich literary history that we may not know about.
And also our history of our laws and in the country. And that's really been, and also land owning and all of it. There's just so much there.
And which ones were followed and which ones were abandoned or taken advantage of, and, you know, the tax items, things like that, you know, how all these things can, who's benefiting from their enforcement or lack thereof.
Mm. Thank you so much, Shanta. This won't be the last time we talk. Mm-hmm. This is our second convo.
Thank you. Thank you both for having me on. I love this conversation.